So today we are. Last week we looked at. We started looking at the origins of Shiva. We looked at the Pashup patterns, and the. We looked at that distinction between the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. Are we going to carry on with that today? And then next week we're going to look at Abhinavagupta, lecture on Abhinavagupta and Shaiva Pratibhigna philosophy. And then we're going to leave all that behind and go on to Hinduism and the modern world in the last 2 weeks. But for now, we're carrying on with our Shaiva, Tantric Shaiva traditions. Now, the sheets in front of you, you've got one two-sided one and one extra one with 36 tapas on it. The two-sided one more or less corresponds to what to the slideshow. But I think there's a few extra bits in the slideshow that aren't on the handout. Now, all this mapping of these traditions is based on the work of Alexis Sanderson in All Souls College, who's really opened up this whole field and shown how in the medieval period, what he calls the Shaiva Age flourished in South India, in India, in the subcontinent. How most of the kings had adherence to Shaivism and patronised Shaiva religions in some way. So we're going to look at these traditions today. Now, if you want to look at there's a kind of scale check, there's an article by Alexis on called Meaning in Tantric Ritual, which is available on his website as a download. And he's got a diagram which is similar to this, but it shows the scale of text. That's not his phrase, that's Ron Inden's phrase, scale of text, from Collingwood, I think. And you've got the Vedas at one side, and the Tantras on the other. The Tantras were regarded as an alternative revelation to the Veda that developed in the medieval period, probably from about the 7th century onwards, perhaps a bit earlier. If you remember, we had the Vedas, which was composed about 1200, 1500 BC, and then the Upanishads about 800 BC, and they were concerned with ritual, particularly sacrifice. And then you get the Upanishads, this idea of the internalization of the sacrifice and the finding of the inner truth, the antaratma, the inner self. And the philosophies that developed around of the Veda were the Mimamsa and the Vedanta, and also Nyaya, which we haven't looked at. We looked at some arguments for the existence of God in Nyaya. So very orthodox, Brahmanical religion, which develops into the Puranas in the Gupta period, and the Guptas end about 600 AD, 600 CE. And it's during the Gupta period, particularly, you get the worship of Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess developing. And also the Smarta Brahmins, if you remember, those who follow the Smritis. Run a long time, a little further, and in the early medieval period, after the post-Guptas, really, you get the Tantric traditions developing, which is the non-Puranic worship of these gods, Vishnu, Shiva, and the goddess. And these Tantric forms became dominant throughout medieval India. And then get eroded with the Muslim incursions into northern India, and then later colonialism. Now these Tantric traditions describe themselves as the higher path, or the Ati Marga, or possibly the outer path. And we looked at that last week, the Pashupata Sutras, if you remember. And the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras, which reveres the Tantras as revelation. Is this clear to everyone, or is it like mud? You've got the your Puranic worship of the gods. So you've got an image of the god, icon of the god in the temple, say, and you make offerings, you do puja, you make offerings and have devotion and receive a blessing back from your offering. And these were ordinary Puranic, highly orthodox worship of Shiva, and their stories are contained in these texts called Puranas, which we looked at briefly a couple of weeks ago. In contrast to that, you get this non-Puranic worship of the same gods, one part of which was called the Atimarga. Sorry, let's take Shiva. The worship of Shiva, the non-Puranic worship of Shiva, is within the Atimarga, the higher or outer path, by these groups called the Pashupatas, who became very important. They were ascetics and became very important and powerful groups in the medieval period. So, for example, they owned the temple at Somnath Temple in Gujarat, which gets sacked by Mahmud of Ghazni in 1023, and the big gold linga stolen. Developing out of the Mantramarga, out of the Atimarga, you get this group called the Mantramarga, the Path of Mantras. And these groups adhered to an alternative revelation called Tantra. These groups of texts called Tantras were the scriptural source of the Mantramarga, the Path of Mantras. So gradually, from here, where you've got adherence, the plus sign is degree of conformity to Vedic values. You've got high degree of conformity to Vedic values, which is dharma, artha, karma, moksha, the three debts that you have in life. Your dharma with regard to your caste, your varna, and your ashrama, your stage of life. And then you've got a minimal adherence to Vedic values at this end. So there's a gradual kind of shift away through history from these Vedic values, Vedika values, with the Shaiva religions. Now, I don't want to exaggerate that shift, but the Mantramarga is divided into two main groups. One is the Shaiva Siddhanta, which are based on a certain group of texts which are called dualist tantras. And then the other group of the Mantramarga is the non-Siddhantika groups, which are based on texts called the Bhairava Tantras and the Kaula Tantras. And these more extreme tantric traditions get Tantra a bad name in a sense. They're the ones that courted pollution completely rejected Vedic values in order to get power. And liberation, particularly power, magical power. And it was these groups that the medieval kings were particularly interested in, because, you know, they offered power. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta, although they say that they worship they adhere to the Tantras, the dualist Tantras, that they still revere the Vedas, the dualist Shaiva Siddhanta. But nominally, what's really important for them is the tantric revelation. So that's the kind of the picture.
Oh, which were the key texts for the Shaiva Siddhanta, the dualist?
There's an important text which is just the earliest Shaiva Siddhanta text is for the Nishvasa Tantra, which is just as we speak being produced, I think, in Pondicherry by Dominic Goodall. But anything by Goodall, there's also the Kirana Tantra, which is translated by Dominic Goodall, and the Parakya Tantra. These are all translated, these texts.
By Dominic Goodall,
yeah.
So what was the final one?
Parakya. And you also get the Pancharatra, which is the Vaishnava tantric Vaishnavism, the tantric worship of Vishnu in the Pancharatra tradition, which feeds into the later Vaishnava traditions as well. And they adhere to a group of texts called the Sankhitas, which I think we looked at those, like the Jayakya.
Yeah.
That's a kind of rough picture. Is everyone happy with that so far? It will get filled out now. Now, the Tantras are the texts of the Mantramarga, and they're composed from the 8th to 11th centuries, and they claim to be revelation from God, from Shiva. And they're usually in the form of a dialogue between Shiva and the goddess, and they claim to go beyond the Veda. And they're composed in the various traditions, the Buddhist Shaiva, Shakta, Vaishnava, Saura, the sun, Tantras, and Garuda, poison, snake poison mainly concerned with. Sluba. There's a good book, one that just come out on the Garuda Tantras by Michael Sluba. There's a lot of work on all this, these traditions has happened in the last, mainly the Lexis's students, has happened in the last 15 years or so. And of course, Buddhist Tantra is so important that it becomes Tibetan Buddhism. Dalai Lama, tantric Buddhist. I don't think he drinks out of skulls, but you never know. Privacy of his bedroom. And then the concern with practice, sadhana, and to achieve liberation, mukti or moksha, and magical powers or pleasure in higher worlds, bhukti or bhoga. So yoga is bhoga. Bhukti is mukti. And they're based on 4 feet, these texts are. This is a later kind of formulation, but originally they were supposed to have a doctrine section, jnana, a yoga section, ritual section, and a behaviour section. Not all texts have those, but it's interesting that there's a sort of layer of text, and so the later texts assume the ritual structures of the earlier texts, so they don't have to go into all of that, because they say, they assume that knowledge is already there. And these traditions gained royal patronage in the medieval period, and were in competition with each other for that patronage. Now there were two, the Shaivas, although I'm calling them all Shaivas, in technical terms, a Shaiva is only somebody who follows the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana, and has been initiated into a Shaiva religion. Now the Maheshwaras were those who followed the Puranas, the Puranic religion, whereas the Shaivas were those who... the Puranic worshippers of Shiva were called Maheshwaras or Shiva Bhaktas, devotees of Shiva. And the non-Puranic ones were called Shaivas in the Mantra Marga because they had to belong to any of these groups, they had to undergo initiation, Bhiksha. And they followed the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana. As a Buddhist follows the teachings of the Buddha Shasana, Bauddha Shasana, so the Shaivas follow the Shiva Shasana, the teachings of Shiva. And it's also linked to this idea of a general revelation and a particular revelation. The general revelation is the Puranic revelation that for the ordinary people, and for the Brahmins, really. And the Vishesha is the particular revelation for those who have the Adhikara, for those who have the ability to understand the teachings. And it was through initiation, Diksha. And Diksha became a ritual act that liberated you, or guaranteed you liberation. So one of the tantras, the Malini Vijayotra, says you get initiated by the guru, and that guarantees your liberation within 7 lifetimes. Later texts say 4 lifetimes, and this kind of, we do it in 4 lifetimes. So this Atimarga, Matrimarga distinction is a textual distinction, but it reflects history to some extent. The Atimarga, we looked at that last week, that's the Pashupatas who cover the ascetics, male ascetics who cover themselves in the cremation, in the ash of cow dung, but not cremation ground ash, because they're still within the Vedic constraint, the purity constraints. Whereas those in the Mantra Marga, the ascetics tended to go beyond those Vedic constraints. And we looked at those last week, so I'm not going to go over them. Now the Shaiva Siddhanta is the fundamental Shaiva system. It's the base. It's like, if you like, if you can't understand Tantric Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism without Mahayana Buddhism, so you can't understand the Kashmiri Shaivism without the Shaiva Siddhanta. The Shaiva Siddhanta is the base tradition. And it still exists, but Chidambaram, big temple centre that I showed you some slides of last week. And here we've got important theologians such as Sadyajyoti, Bhattanarayana Kanta, and his son Rama Kanta. And it spreads south to the Tamil country, where it gets caught up with Tamil Bhakti, the Nayanals, these poets, also Vaishnava poets, who were devoted to the icon of the deity in the temple and wrote wonderful poetry in Tamil to these deities. So the same happens with the Shaivas. So it originally starts in the north as a Gnostic system, if you like, a ritualistic system, and ends up in the south as a devotional bhakti-based system. And these are important theologians. Soma Shambhu wrote a ritual manual called a Padati, the Soma Shambhu Padati, which is terribly important for our understanding of the ritual procedures in this religion. And there's a French translation of that by Hélène Brunner, four volumes. But there's also a book in English by Davis. I can't remember his first name. But it's called Ritual in an Oscillating Universe. And that's really based on her work, but that's a good English summary of the Shaiva Siddhanta practices. And there's also a book by Dunu Villa. Called Shaiva Siddhanta Theology. It's quite old now, but it gives you the basics of the Shaiva Siddhanta view. But I still think Dominic Goodall's Introduction to the Kirana Tantra is probably the best to look at. Agoura Shiva, another important theologian in this tradition, and they have three ontological categories, Pati, Parsha, and Pashu. Pati is God, the Lord, transcendent God, Shiva. Parsha is the bond, which is the universe. And Pashu is the beast, the creature which is bound by the bond of the universe, i.e. the soul, the individual soul. So as a cow, as a Pashu, is bound by a noose, so the soul is bound by the universe, until released by Pati, by the grace of God. Now, Pati, the Lord, Shiva, has five acts. He has creation, creates the universe, I'll go over this in a second, maintains the universe, destroys it, conceals himself, and reveals himself. Anugraha and Tirudana, these concealing and revealing. Now when I say creates the universe, he doesn't actually create it from nothing. He acts upon pre-existing matter. The universe has no beginning in Shaivism. So there's kind of a blob of matter, if you like, that Shiva acts upon, and then that creates the manifest universe that we see. And after a period of time, that manifest universe can contract back into its drop, into the bindu, back into its potentiality. So Shiva acts on the universe. He doesn't act directly, he acts through a series of agents called the Vidyeshwaras, who create the universe or who act upon the universe. Of course, Shiva himself is completely transcendent and doesn't actually have contact with the world or with the universe other than through his agents. There's a maintenance. He maintains the universe and he destroys it at the end of an aeon, at the end of an age. And he has these functions of concealing and revealing. Why does he do that? One text says Shiva, vision of Shiva says, as a king dresses up as a foot soldier and goes among the troops, so Shiva dresses up as the universe and goes amongst the manifestation. So he conceals himself and reveals himself. Now the Parsha is the bond which is the universe itself. And in the Shaiva Siddhanta system, There are millions of worlds of Bhuvanas, and they're categorized into 224 levels, but each level contains many, many thousands of worlds. And they formulated this in terms of...
Sorry, what type of worlds? Is this the physical, or is this material, or is this ontological, as it were?
These Bhuvanas, are worlds that you can't... they're not... There's this world, which is a physical world.
Which is, yes.
And then there are these other worlds, which are non-physical. You can't see.
So it's both. I wasn't quite sure.
You can't see with your eyes. Yeah. But they're in these higher levels of the cosmos. So the Malini Vijayutra has a list of these worlds. And it's interesting. You can do sort of archaeology of the texts through looking at the Bhuvana. Each tantra has got a section called the chapter on the world. Well, not all of them do, but many. And if this is the physical world here, below it you've got the patanas, different levels of different hell levels. And then above you've got different heaven levels. So whatever system it is, they always add their own level at the top. So the Rudra Bhuvana, for example, or Dhruva, which is the pole star, the level of the world of Dhruva. And then you get the other Shaiva systems coming on, putting their own worlds above that. So the Shiva Loka, which is the world of Shiva in the Puranas, gets transcended by Dhruva, the next level up, by another group. So our heaven transcends the heaven of the earlier groups. So you can do an archaeology of the texts in this way, going back through the different levels. Now in that list you've got in front of you, you've got the 36 tattvas. This is their cosmical scheme. This is the heart of the Shaiva Siddhanta theological system. Now you've got the universe is divided into two broad levels, the pure universe and the impure universe. So the pure universe is a 1 to 5. You've got Shiva and Shakti, Shiva and the goddess together. And they emanate, these gods, Sadashiva, Ishvara and Shuddhavidya. Now, Shiva and Shakti together are so transcendent that they're not objects of worship. The object of worship of the Shaiva Siddhanta is this god Sadashiva. I might have a picture of Sadashiva, but he is the five-headed white form of Shiva who's worshipped by the Shaiva Siddhanta. They also worship Shiva in the form of the Linga, of course, particularly in South India. But Sadashiva is the focus of worship. And he emanates these other deities. And lower than Shuddhavidya, you've got the impure universe, which is all the rest of it. Now, if you look down the list, you've got 12 to 36, you've got Purusha, Prakriti, Buddhi, Ahankara, and so on. Now, that's all the Samkhya tattvas. That's the tattvas from Samkhya, if you remember, that we looked at last term. Now, the Shaivas have added their own 11 tattvas onto the Samkhya tattvas. It's a very common pattern in Indian religions that the later traditions develop new categories and put them on top of the old ones. So the Purusha, you've got these Shaiva categories like Maya, and out of Maya comes these coverings of Kala, particular, the power of particular agency. They're all limiting factors. Vidya, Raga, Passion, Kala, Time, and Niyati, Constraint, or Fates and Vengeances. Now, they're aware that they're sticking their own categories on top of the Samkhya ones, and they marry the two together in quite interesting ways, which we won't have time to go into. But Maya is the top of the impure universe, and it's where the universe contracts back into. It contracts back into Maya, which is unmanifested, avyakta. And then it becomes manifested, and over again. Another important word in the Shaiva Siddhanta for Maya is bindu. Bindu means drop. Well, Bindi. Bindi comes from that, you know, because Bindi's Bindu. Fashion items. Bindu drop. And it's the drop into which the universe contracts and then expands out, explodes out. Now, in the Vaishnava version of this, the Purusha is not an individual being, but is they call it the beehive of the cells, the beehive. So you've got these two things, Maya and Purusha, at the top of the impure universe. Maya is the material potentiality, and the Purusha is the connectivity of all the souls that get reabsorbed back into the top of the universe before they get thrown out again at the end of the of an aeon, the beginning of an aeon, in a never-ending process until each one is liberated. I don't expect you to, you know, I won't go into all the details of this, but there's the structure for you. Now, on the right hand, you've got these experience. Now, these are different kinds of beings that exist at these different levels of the universe. So looking at the bottom, the sakala, those who are with qualities, and they have the qualities of individuality, karma, and delusion, maya. That's us, and rabbits and tortoises, they're all sakalas, they're all beings caught within the universe, with the pollution of individuality, action, and delusion, which keeps us bound as sakalas. Now the next level up are the pralaya kalas, those who have gone into the disillusion, the pralaya, and they have the two impurities of individuality, anava, and karma. And then the next level up is the vijnana kalas, those conscious of vijnana kavalas, the consciousness only beings who have only the pollution of individuality. Now all of these beings will get reborn out of that state. They're there because of their karma, because of karmic reasons, but they'll get reborn out of that state in due course. Now, above them, once you transcend the impure universe, you go into these levels, these beings called mantras, which are also formulas, you know, sound formulas, but they're regarded as beings in the system. Mantreshwaras, the lords of mantra, and the mantra maheshwaras, or the vidyeshwaras. And it's one of the Vidyeshwaras, Ananta, who creates the universe for Shiva.
That's the lord of the mantras.
Yes, the lord, yeah. The lord, the mantra Maheshwar, the great lord of the mantras. And there are eight of them. The top dog is Ananta, and he acts upon the universe for Shiva. And we saw a picture of him last week. I don't think I've got one this week. But he becomes a guardian of the threshold, one of those ferocious guardians who guard the doors of the temples. So if you've got I don't expect you to know the details, but you've got the general idea that the universe in the Shaiva Siddhanta goes from a pure state to an impure state, a material state. And in the pure state, you've got these higher beings, like angelic beings, if you like. And in the impure state, you've got the universe, the material universe, which is shalata, which is coagulated, which is a coagulation, a solidification of these more subtle powers. As gulas, as sweets are a coagulation of sugar cane juice, so the universe is a coagulation of this subtle matter. Oh, there they are. Yeah, we've done that. Now, the doctrines of the Shaiva Siddhanta are, at liberation, you become equal to Shiva. Now, you don't merge with Shiva, because you're ontologically distinct. Your Atman is separate from Shiva, so it can never merge with Shiva. But you can attain Shiva Tulya, equality with Shiva, likeness to Shiva, but not identity with Shiva. And how do you get that liberation? You get it through grace, through prasada, through the grace of Shiva, anugraha, and initiation by a guru, which is the same thing in a way. Once you get initiated by the guru, that's a manifestation of the grace of Shiva. and the Shiva enters the guru at initiation to initiate you. So at initiation, this guru will enter. So the Sanat Sharma Padali and also Richard Davis's book describes these rituals. So the guru, who's possessed in a sense by Shiva, will initiate you by giving you a mantra, and there's a cord. He takes a cord which is the length of your body, and the 36 tattvas are mapped onto the cord, and the guru cuts the cord from the feet upwards, representing the dissolution of your old self, and then the recreation of your new self as a devotee of Shiva. And this initiation was only open to men, and women participated vicariously through their husbands and achieved liberation through that way, through that route, if their husbands got liberated. And the initiation in the Shabbat, there was a common initiation which gave access to the texts, and there was final liberation initiation, the Nirvana Diksha, which gave you guaranteed liberation. So in a way, there's no point in the Samaya Diksha, so they conflated them together. They did it all in one rite. They still do. Samaya and the Nirvana Diksha come together. And then also at that point, after your Nirvana Diksha, you can have a choice of becoming a sadhaka, a seeker after power, or a consecration as a teacher, acharya. You could have those options. There's further options to pursue in this system. Now, having undergone initiation, the Shaiva Siddhantin, if you're very devoted, you undergo the three junctures of the day, at dawn, midday, and twilight, the sandhyas. You'd undergo this ritual process of purifying the body, purification of the elements of the body, Bhuta Shuddhi, which I've talked about before, the creating of a divine body through imposing mantras on the body, visualization of the god, deity, and external worship. So you imagine Shiva or Sadashiva above the top of your head, and then he comes down through the crown of your head, and you seat him on a throne in your heart, where you worship him in your imagination.
Is that what you called in your book a texturization?
Yeah, that's what I meant by it. In texturization of the body, because it's focused based on these texts, and the text is mapped onto the body.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah, and then that's followed by external worship into a linga, Shiva linga, where you offer petals, flowers, incense, smells to the external object. And you do that, it's totally time consuming, you do that three times a day. They can actually do it quite quickly, these characters. And there's some pictures that it's interesting. There's this guy, I think he makes a living doing it. He's in photographs of him doing this practice in Helen Bruno's book. And he also pops up in Davis's book as well, doing the same thing. And there's another publication, he's in that. And you can see him getting older in these photographs. It's quite interesting. Tantric prayer. And part of this is tantric prayer that is a visualization. And the visualized deity is also a mantra. And the practitioner must become the deity to worship the deity. In tantric traditions, the mantra marga, the idea is that you only a god can worship a god, so you become the god to worship, symbolically become the god to worship the god. And this is the case even for metaphysically dualist traditions such as the Shaiva Siddhanta. And Dominic Goodall's edited an interesting book on this called Agora Shiva's Hymn to the Five Rings of Deities, the Panchavarana Stotra. I think you should choose better titles for his books, because I don't think they'll sell very good if you have a title like that. But it's an interesting book. And okay, so that's Shaiva Siddhanta, Orthodox Shaivism that worships, reveres the Tantras, and is terribly complex in its ritual procedures, and has this hierarchical view of the universe. And so for that death, you'll be liberated if you follow this ritual procedure.
with the grace of the Guru, with the grace of, the of Shiva through the Guru. Alongside that, you get these other traditions developing called non-Siddhantika, which we call non-Siddhantika traditions, which used to be called Kashmir Shaivism, but they went beyond they existed beyond the limits of Kashmir. So the geographical restriction is not really accurate, because they were pan-Indian, really. And these revered tantras called the Bhairava Tantras. And these were composed probably by groups of ascetics called Karpalikas, skull-bearing ascetics, whose predecessors were the Pashupata ascetics. But the Karpalikas are more extreme, and they court pollution. They cover themselves in the ashes of cremation grounds, not cow dung, thereby consciously polluting themselves and putting two fingers up to the Vedic tradition, in a sense. We can have power. We can have power through our transgressing of the boundaries of Vedic orthodoxy. And these characters lived in cremation grounds, and they were so polluting for a highly orthodox Brahmin that if he saw one, he had to stare into the sun to purify his eyes. These were unseeables for the orthodox Brahmin, these characters. And they still exist today, and they're called Agoris, the non-terrible ones. And they don't have conformity to the Veda. And there's a picture of a contemporary Agori drinking out of a skull. he would have found his Brahmin skull and made it into a begging bowl. And there's a very interesting article by Jonathan Parry on the Agoris of Benares. In that book, Death in Benares, there's a chapter on the Agoris. And it must be about 15 years old, that article now, but he shows there how actually the Agori religion is becoming gentrified in a way. It's becoming a sort of middle class Indian interest. and there was a guru called Killa Ram. He's probably passed away now, but who was a Agori guru about 20 years ago. So there's the Agoris, and you gain liberation and power through rejecting orthodox values and norms of society. So I think they're fairly dramatic kind of characters, really. Now, between these groups, let's just go back a second. So, just to recap, you've got this Shaiva Siddhanta, which I've just described, with the 36 tattvas, purity and impurity, the universe, liberation through initiation, and the grace of the Guru, are following a complex ritual procedure every day of your life. And then opposite that, you've got the non-Siddhanta traditions, which assumes all that, but wants to go beyond it to liberation and power through rejecting orthodox Vedic values. And you get tantras called the Bhairava Tantras and the Kaula Tantras. The Kaula means the goddess tantras. And in this group you get the Karpalikas, probably produced these texts, and the Agoris are a modern descendant of the Karpalikas in the contemporary world. So although these are still relevant, these traditions. So the Shaiva Siddhanta still carries on down to today, and the non-Siddhantika traditions still carry on down to today. And you can see those in the Agoris. And also the Vedic Puranic worship still carries on down to the present. Now the Natra Tantra is a text between these two groups, between the Shaiva Siddhanta and the non-Siddhanta text. It's technically a Bhairava Tantra, but it was adopted by the kings of the time in order to protect for protection.
Between Bhairava and Kaula Tantras, or between...
Between the non-Siddhantika and the Shaiva Siddhanta, really. Between orthopraxy, if you like, and the Kaula cults. So there's about 700 to 850 CE or AD. And this was the priest operating in the king's court. There's, Alexis Sanderson has written an interesting article on this, which you can find on his website. And this was a very popular god called Amriteshvara, the lord of immortality, popular in the Kashmir Valley at the time. He's also known as the conqueror of death, Mrityunjit, Mrityunjaya, and Netranar, the lord of the eye. So the Netra Tantra is the eye tantra. It's like Lord of the Rings eye, you know, the all-seeing eye. And the mantra is Om Jum Sa. That's the shorter version. There's also a long version. So it's a focus of Om Jum Sa, which is identified with the eye of Shiva. And there's a commentary by the non-dualist Shaiva theologian Shivaraja. And there, he was very popular in the Kashmir Valley and isn't any longer because there's not much Hinduism left there. But here's Amriteshvara and his Amriteshvari, the goddess. Very, very popular at the time. These are representations. These were icons that you would offer external worship to after your inner practice. And there's the Netra Tantra Nepalese text. And in that text, it's got the body as a symbolic system. The body is arranged in a vertical axis that you visualize, and you get these chakras and radharas located on the body. You've probably heard of the chakras from yoga classes or something. Well, this is all in these kinds of texts. These different centers of the body, which are mapped onto the universe in a hierarchical sequence. So,
sorry, what are ardharas?
Ardhara is a support. Is a support. So, they're like chakras.
Right,
yeah.
Sorry, I just.
Yeah, I mean, no, don't be sorry. What are ardharas? Is a very good question. These are the chakras. I mean these words. There's several words. There's chakra, ardhara, granti. There's probably a couple of others there.
Yes,
and they're all mapped onto each other. Now, what they are is,
yeah.
I think.
I see. No,
your
I
guess
don't.
Is as good as mine,
yeah.
Baby.
Yeah.
Now, these are the chakras in one in an 18th century representation. There's thought to be a channel going from the crown of the head to the base of the body, and these chakras or centers of power are located along it. And you may have heard of Kundalini. You, through breathing practices, you awaken the Kundalini who rises up, piercing the chakras to the crown of the head where she unites with Shiva, and you're liberated, or that the body is filled with bliss. So that's a model that occurs in the Netra Tantra and other tantras. This system of the six or seven chakras has its origin in a text called the 11th century Kubji Karmata Tantra. Although the idea of centres probably goes back older, there's the heart centre here, which seems to be some reference to that in the Upanishads. And there's a famous hymn that I often go on about called the circle, the hymn to the circle of deities located in the body, the Dehi Hasta Devata Chakra Stotra, where you visualise a lotus in your chest. And you map on these goddesses onto it. So at the moment, it's got the Guru in the middle there, Shiva, Chaitanya consciousness, and you've Ananda Bhairava in union with Ananda Bhairavi in your heart. And on the petals of the lotus are different goddesses, the goddesses of the senses, worshipping Shiva. And that's a description of the liturgy there, and it's accompanied by a hymn. Did I give you the hymn? No, I haven't. Never mind. There's a hymn, Vande, I praise the Ganapati whose body is the inhaled breath. I praise Vatuka who is the exhaled breath. I praise all these different goddesses of the senses. Now these goddesses became subjects of iconography and as the seven mothers, the Saptamatrikas. So these are all goddesses of the senses. So Brahmani with the five heads is the goddess, is the Shakti, the energy of Brahma, whose subject is the eye, who controls vision. So she offers vision to Shiva, Ananda Bhairava in the heart. and then you get these other goddesses. So you get Varahi, the boar-headed goddess, the wife of Varaha, Shakti Varaha. And then you get Chamunda, the ferocious, emaciated goddess, skeletal goddess, who is the goddess of touch, who offers flowers of touch to Ananda Bhairava. So these became objects of, in themselves, of devotion. This is the Panchalingeshvara temple in Karnataka. Now, the various questions arising from all this kind of material, why is the cosmic hierarchy so complicated in these religions? One answer to that is possibly that they try to synthesize and bring together different diverse systems which are, had originally arisen independently of each other. And the Shaiva Siddhanta and other traditions try to bring them together into a coherent model. And thereby sort of colonizing these other religions in a sense. Another question, do tantric traditions develop from Vedic Brahmanical religion? Oh, the other thing, I didn't mention tantric sex, did I? Well, that's the that's what happens in the more extreme left-hand Kaula traditions. They flaunt caste purity rules through courting impurity like cremation ground ash, and caste-free sex in a ritual setting to transcend the boundaries of the ritual restrictions of Brahmanical orthopraxy. So do these traditions develop from Vedic? It's an interesting question. They certainly seem to have occurred on the edges of Vedic influence in Nepal, Kashmir. But they certainly develop as a reaction against the Brahmanical traditions. And that's what's important. A reaction against those Vedic values. So, you know, life could be better than this. There's a higher goal that we can reach, liberation and power. Another question, what's the relationship between the Buddhist, Shaiva and Pancharatra tantric traditions? Another interesting question. Some scholars argue that they come from a shared source. Others, like Alexis, fairly convincing in my view, argues that the Buddhist tantras come from the Shaiva tantras. And you can actually show, and Isaac Harunaka, Isaacson in Hamburg has shown this as well, where you can get an interesting lecture here. Where he's got texts, and you can see the Buddhist texts and the Shaiva texts, and the Buddhist texts have scrubbed out the word Bhairava and put Haruka, or, you know, a Buddhist deity in its place. Now, what's the meaning or function of erotic and impure worship? And you have to see it in the context of the flaunting of orthodox values, I think. And that's terribly important. And is tantra a philosophy? Is there tantric philosophy? Well, yes and no. It's mostly practice, but there is also some philosophy that we're going to look at next week that developed in Kashmir with a school called the Pratyabhijna tradition, the recognition tradition, particularly of Abhinavagupta and his followers. So that's our whiz through the Mantramarga, Tantric Shaivism.